What are the seven wonders of Middle-earth, the greatest, most amazing, most wonderful structures in Tolkien's world? Hi everyone, this is Robert. Welcome to In Deep Geek. On this channel you find theories, explanations and lore videos about The Lord of the Rings, A Song of Ice and Fire, The Witcher and much more. Welcome. What are the seven wonders of Middle-earth? Well, let's do a couple of quick disclaimers first. We should be clear that although Tolkien describes many wondrous things in his world, he never made a formal list of wonders, so this list is mine. I'm sure you'll agree with some of my picks, but maybe not others. Feel free to put your list in the comments below. Second, this is a list of Middle-earth wonders, not from Arda more broadly, so we're not talking about anything shaped by the Valar themselves, say. And finally, like the seven wonders in our world, this list is of buildings and constructions rather than natural wonders or impressive small crafted items, so no rings, for example. And with all that said, let's get started. First, we have the Argonath. Probably the most obvious wonder-like creation in Middle-earth, these two statues flank the River Anduin at the northern end of the Nenhithuil Lake. The Fellowship memorably paddle past them in the Fellowship of the Ring. Known also as the Gate of Kings or the Pillars of the Kings, the Argonath were built at the instructions of Minalcar, the regent of Gondor who later became King Remendakil II, in the 13th century of the Third Age. Minalcar had led Gondor to a victory over the Easterlings and set to fortifying Gondor's borders, including along the mighty River Anduin. At the northernmost point of Gondor's lands, at the north end of the Nenhithuil, he built two enormous statues, one of Isildur and the other Anarion, the founders and first rulers of Gondor. They are stood on huge plinths staring northwards, each with an axe in their right hand and their left hand held up in a gesture of defiance. The message was clear. Passing beyond those statues brought you into Gondor, and Gondor was protected. By the time the Fellowship passes by them, some 1700 years or so later, they no longer marked the northern end of Gondor's land. That was much diminished by then, and time and weather had beaten away the finer details of the carving. But still, they were awe-inspiring and magnificent. We read this. As Frodo was borne towards them, the great pillars rose like towers to meet him. Giants, they seemed to him, vast grey figures, silent but threatening. Then he saw that they were indeed shaped and fashioned. The craft and power of old had wrought upon them, and still they preserved through the suns and rains of forgotten years the mighty likenesses in which they had been hewn. Upon great pedestals founded in the deep waters stood two great kings of stone. Still with blurred eyes and crannied brows they frowned upon the north. Great power and majesty they still wore. The silent wardens of a long-vanished kingdom. Awe and fear fell upon Frodo, and he cowered down, shutting his eyes and not daring to look up as the boat drew near. Even Boromir bowed his head as the boats whirled by, frail and fleeting as little leaves, under the enduring shadow of the sentinels of Numenor. 2. The Thousand Caves of Menigroth. Millennia earlier, in the Years of the Trees, when Melkor was still chained and the Noldor elves still lived peacefully in the Undying Lands, some elves lived in Middle-earth led by Thingol and his wife Melian, the Maia. At her prompting, and with some apparent foresight, Thingol took to building a magnificent, defendable home for his people, part palace, part fortress. The only way in was a single high stone bridge over the river Eskelduin, leading to gates and wide passages heading deep down underneath the hill, opening out into halls and chambers one after another, carved out of the living rock. Its creation was a collaborative effort. In the Silmarillion, we read that elves and dwarves together, each with their own skill, there wrought out the visions of Melian, images of the wonder and beauty of Valinor beyond the sea. The pillars of Menigroth were hewn in the likeness of the beeches of Orome, stock, bough, and leaf, and they were lit with lanterns of gold. The nightingales sang there as in the gardens of Lorien, and there were fountains of silver and basins of marble and floors of many-coloured stones. Carven figures of beasts and birds there ran upon the walls, or climbed upon the pillars, or peered among the branches entwined with many flowers. And as the years passed, Melian and her maidens filled the halls with woven hangings wherein could be read the deeds of the Valar, and the many things that had befallen in Arda since its beginning, and shadows of things that were yet to be. That was the fairest dwelling of any king that has ever been east of the sea. Perhaps it was its creation under the artistic vision of Amaya, the reflection of Valinor itself, or the complementary skills of elves and dwarves. Menegroth was indisputably a wonder of the First Age, the fairest dwelling of any king in Middle-earth. Tragedy followed, though, and as was so often the case, it was caused by a lust for one of the Silmarils. King Thingol of Menegroth had one of the Silmarils and commissioned the dwarves there to refashion the Nauglamir, a famed and beautiful necklace first wrought by dwarves to allow it to hold the Silmaril. Having done this, the dwarves claimed it for their own, killed Thingol, and escaped. A whole series of reprisals took place on both sides, during which Menegroth was successfully assaulted by the dwarves. The elves won it back, but were seriously depleted. A second attack, this time by elves, the sons of Feanor and their followers, led to more destruction, and Menegroth did not endure. A sad end to an unparalleled construction. Next up, number 3. Orthanc. There is a lot we don't know about Orthanc. Exactly when it was built, or how, or who by. It rises over 500 feet from the ground, a solitary tower, lonely in the centre of the huge ring of Isengard's defensive wall. What we know is that it must have been built towards the end of the Second Age, after the founding of the post-Numenorean lands of Gondor and Arnor. It was erected at the far northwestern tip of Gondor. This was well before Rohan had been established, and used to house one of the 7 Palantiri, the magical seeing stones through which the disparate kingdoms could communicate with one another. It kept that function until the Great Plague of 1636 in the Third Age, when the Tower of Orthanc was locked shut, not to be opened until it was given to Saruman, who had returned from his travels in the east of Middle-earth. He took up residence there, found the Palantir, and the rest we know from the Lord of the Rings. What makes Orthanc so wondrous, though, is its construction. It seems to rear up out of the earth itself. 4 huge, many-sided stone pillars of shining black stone fused together. At its pinnacle, where Gandalf was imprisoned by Saruman, the 4 pillars opened out into 4 sharp pinnacles, like a dark crown, and between them a flat, shiny floor covered in mysterious symbols. As Tolkien described it, it seemed a thing not made by the craft of men, but riven from the bones of the earth in the ancient torment of the hills. Fans of A Song of Ice and Fire will no doubt at this point think of the ancient mysterious constructions of shiny black fused rock that dot the landscape of Westeros and Essos. I'm sure George R. R. Martin took inspiration from Orthanc when inventing them. Orthanc and the immense Circle of Isengard, a mile in diameter with but one entrance, were built with the last memories of the splendour of Numenor. Orthanc is a mystery because Tolkien wants it to be a mystery. The technology or magic that forged it and caused it to rise up are long forgotten, relics of the golden age of humanity. 4th, Barad-dûr. Although Orthanc is tall, it isn't the tallest built structure in Middle-earth. That honour is reserved for the Dark Tower in Barad-dûr, Sauron's fortress in Mordor. We don't know exactly how tall it is, but Tolkien describes Orthanc, standing at 500 feet or 150 metres or so, as like a child's model compared to it. In the movie version, it was 10 times the height. Barad-dûr was undoubtedly the greatest and most formidable fortress of the Second and Third Ages. Its original construction took 600 years and stood for the best part of 2 millennia. 100 miles southeast of the Black Gate into Mordor, it sat at the end of the southern spur of the Ash Mountains, high and proud. It descended deep underground, with dungeons, caves and prisons, and above ground were numberless towers and battlements. The whole thing was made of hard, almost unbreakable stones and metals, iron, steel, and adamant. And it appeared black, darker even than the clouds and shadows which shrouded it much of the time. And topping it all was the Dark Tower itself. It was from there that the Eye of Sauron kept watch over Middle-earth. That first construction was destroyed after Sauron's defeat at the end of the Second Age, though the foundations of the Dark Tower could not be destroyed, they were so strong. And Barad-dûr was rebuilt at the end of the Third Age, after Sauron returned to Mordor from Dol Guldur. Although the shadow of Barad-dûr looms large in The Lord of the Rings, we don't really get to see it much. Perhaps poetically, the best view Frodo gets is from mere seconds before it fell. A brief vision he had of swirling cloud, and in the midst of it, towers and battlements, tall as hills, founded upon a mighty mountain throne, above immeasurable pits, great courts and dungeons, eyeless prisons sheer as cliffs, and gaping gates of steel and adamant. And then all passed. After the destruction of the ring, the Dark Tower, built and held together by Sauron's black grip, crumbled. There is no doubt that Barad-dûr was wondrous in its scale and construction, horrific, black and blighted, but wondrous. Fifth, Minas Tirith. This is the third and final pick from the post-Numenorean Gondorian Renaissance in the late second and early third ages of Middle-earth. Minas Tirith, then known as Minas Anor, the Tower of the Sun, was built in the late second age of Middle-earth in the early years of Gondor. It was the twin fortress to Minas Ithil, the Tower of the Moon. These two towers flanked Osgiliath, then capital of Gondor. Each received a palantir, and each held a place of honour in the early Gondorian Empire. What sets Minas Tirith apart, however, is how it developed. Minas Ithil eventually fell to Sauron's forces, as did Osgiliath, which left Minas Tirith the capital and mainstay of Gondor, and the tower developed into a city. The White Tree of Gondor, the symbol of Gondor, a remnant of its Numenorean heritage, was planted and grew there. The fortifications of the tower, which stood on an outthrust spur of Mount Mindoluin, spread out and downwards, forming levels of the city down to the ancient outer wall, made of the same fused black stone as Orthanc. Each of the seven levels was surrounded by a white wall, hence the moniker the White Tower or White City, despite its black outer wall. And the gate to each level faced in a different direction, so the path to the top zigzagged, making any assault more arduous. But perhaps Minas Tirith's glory was its gate. Huge and set at its eastern edge, cast of iron and steel, this held back invaders for millennia until it finally succumbed to Grond, that great battering ram, and words of power and fell magic from the Witch King of Angmar. It was replaced in the early years of the Fourth Age with something even more majestic. Gimli, together with dwarves from the Lonely Mountain and elven artisans, made new gates forged from iron and mithril. Gates to last the ages. Sixth, Carras Caladhan in Lothlorien. While most of the wonders we have talked about so far have been built by the ingenuity of men, dwarves and dark folk, Carras Caladhan is purely elven. And it is purely natural, or to be more accurate, the results of elves and elven magic working together with nature. While most of the others on this list can claim to be taller or bigger or more indomitable, Lothlorien's claim is simply its naturalistic beauty. The language Tolkien uses to describe Carras Caladhan is almost ethereal. We read of a deep foss lost in soft shadow, but the grass upon its brink was green as if it glowed still in memory of the sun that had gone. Or of the Malorn trees we hear of their many-tiered branches, and amid their ever-moving leaves countless lights were gleaming, green and gold and silver. And the city itself is ever climbing up like a green cloud upon their left, and as the night deepened, more lights sprang forth, until all the hill seemed afire with stars. There are structures here, flets and stairways, a defensive wall and gateway, places to live and eat and sleep, but Tolkien wants us more to get a feel for the place. This is an earthly paradise, a place where no evil can penetrate, where the rigours of ageing and decay are held back. It is sustained, protected and hidden by the power of Nenya, one of the three elven rings of power. But as much as it is idyllic, it is also tragic. For when the One Ring was destroyed, Nenya lost its power too, and Lothlorien faded. Arwen visits there a bit over a century later to find it abandoned, empty, and given over once more to nature. It is where she chose to surrender her own life after the death of her husband. Tolkien loved nature and trees, and although Lothlorien may not be on everyone's list of the greatest wonders of Middle-earth, I suspect it might be on Tolkien's. And before I do my final pick, let's just name-check a few honourable mentions. Gondolin, the hidden city, is a major part of Tolkien's First Age and is undoubtedly amazing, but Tolkien made it clear, in my view, that Menigroth was the more impressive. Erebor, the Lonely Mountain, is a similar case. There is no doubt that it, with its wealth, were mind-boggling, but they pale into insignificance compared to the seventh of our wonders, which we'll get onto in a moment. Osgiliath was once the capital of Gondor, and its famed Long Bridge could perhaps have made this list, but it fell halfway through the Second Age. Angband, Morgoth's First Age fortress, could probably qualify as the greatest stronghold in Middle-earth. It was, to all intents and purposes, besieged for hundreds of years of the First Age without succumbing, but its claims to being wondrous are slightly undermined by its towers and mountains being slag heaps. Impressive in scale, undoubtedly, but wondrous, perhaps not. Finally, in the almost made it list, we have the White Towers, and in particular, the westernmost tower, Elistirion. In this tower, right in the westernmost reaches of Middle-earth, was a palantir, which allowed watchers to see Tol Eressëa, the island just off the coast of the Undying Lands. Elves treated this tower as a place of pilgrimage, therefore. A wonder, no doubt, but not one of my seven. So finally, number seven, Khazad-dûm. In the book and the movies, we visit Khazad-dûm Moria well after its heyday. It is dark and dangerous and not the kind of place you would want to stay any longer than you had to. But when it was built, it was awe-inspiring. Indeed, it became known as the greatest city ever known. It was founded by Durin the First in ancient times, starting with the great gates at the eastern edge of the Misty Mountains near the Miramir. These were, for millennia, the only way in or out, and inscribed with runic spells barring entrance to enemies. Further in, beyond that, a narrow bridge spanning a great chasm offered more protection. No army could cross it all at once. And the dwarves mined and excavated deeper and wider and higher and further into the mountains. There were mines of gold and gems and, most valuable of all, mithril, but this was no mere mining colony. The sheer scale of it alone boggles the mind. It extended right across the Misty Mountains, 4 days' travel from west to east, and perhaps the same again from north to south, and extending across many, many levels up and down. The endless stair goes from the deepest dungeons far below the mountains to the very highest peak above, many thousands of stairs in one unbroken spiral, and each layer was complex. We're told of stairs and arches, and of other passages and tunnels sloping up or running steeply down or opening blankly dark on either side beyond hope of remembering. But just as importantly, Khazad-dûm was not bleak and grey and just functional. It was beautiful. There were many pillared chambers, archways and chambers with polished walls as smooth as glass, and it was bright and full of light. The higher levels let light in from the mountaintops, and we're told that even the lower levels were full of light and splendour, with treasures and armouries and natural beauty. Lower levels were brought to life by many lamps of crystal. Of course, by the time of the Lord of the Rings, this splendour was gone, the dwarves driven out by the Balrog and orcs. Attempts were made to reclaim it, but to no avail, and it soon lived up to its elven name of Moria, meaning Dark Abyss. There is a happier end to this story, though. Whereas most of these wonders faded over time, Tolkien tells us that dwarves did return to Khazad-dûm in the Fourth Age, after the destruction of the Ring, and though it may have faded from history, the creators of this great wonder stayed there, until the world grew old, and the dwarves failed, and the days of Durin's race were ended. But what do you think? What would you include in your list of seven wonders of Middle-earth? let me know in the comments below. If you'd like to see more Lord of the Rings videos, please click on the link appearing now on the left of your screen. Or to support this channel, thank you. Please click on the link to Patreon on the right of your screen. That's all for this time. Thanks for watching. I'll see you again soon.